The following podcast contains explicit language.
This is the first real victory, however temporary, for the resistance.
Come on, you're the commander-in-chief. You can't be disappointed with the outcome of a federal case and say, well, the so-called judge.
Any negative polls are fake news. You got that?
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who says that negative news is fake news. Donald Trump.
Beautiful.
I'm Jacob Weisberg, and I want to introduce my new co-hosts on the show. Sitting next to me, Virginia Heffernan, who writes for all the best publications, New York Times Magazine, many others. You should read her book, Magic and Loss, which is fantastic. It's a bedside book at my house because my wife has been reading it right now and highly recommends it. And Jamelle Bouie, Slate's chief political correspondent.
Hello.
Hi.
Jamelle, you're looking particularly splendid this evening. This is a radio show. People can't see. You have on a light-colored tweed suit with a purple knit tie.
Yes, and these bipartisan tie.
Bipartisan tie, yes.
Very nice.
Very nice. And Virginia. Motorcycle jacket, flower dress.
That's right. You
suede can say boots. Anything, though. These guys are looking cool. Those of you who are going
to
be listening
at
home.
Trying to keep our spirits up, I think.
Yeah. So we're going to be following kind of a GabFest format tonight. We've got three topics, and I'm very excited. We have a special guest who's going to be joining us for a segment later, Dahlia Lithwick.
Yeah. She's going to come down like Gaga last night. It's going to be great.
Exactly. First topic I want to ask you guys about is Steve Bannon. And we may get a little bumper part about Steve Miller.
Yeah.
But I want us to try to dig a little deeper and try to understand what Steve Bannon's all about. But first, he's on the cover of Time magazine
this week.
Which is the thing that is going to turn Donald Trump against him, because Donald Trump does not want it on the cover of Time magazine. But they put him on the cover, but, you know, he looks like a florid drunk. I mean, this is like close-up photo with the burst blood vessels. He looks like Charles Bukowski. Did you see Barfly?
Yes,
kind of like one of the later scenes of that. It's not a flattering photograph.
I mean, my reference point in my head was he looked like a villain from a Pokemon cartoon. But that's But I'm a millennial, so that's where my head's at.
Are you trying to get that monster?
Yeah, trying to get that.
Rosacea. We just learned also Trump in heavy treatment for...
is that the medical term for burst blood vessels in your face
I'm
from drinking?
I'm the only Irish-American up here, so I know from rosacea, and I recognize a fellow sufferer in Steve Bannon. See, we can start our compassion there. We all have dermatological issues.
Yeah.
But actually, speaking of identity politics, I'm a little worried when I try to fathom the mind of Steve Bannon that I am incapable, because... I don't know how, maybe he's just inscrutable to me as a man. I just don't know how little Steve Bannon was born to his working class family, and he was a baby, and he grew up from that beautiful baby to be Steve Bannon.
All right. Become a John Carpenter character. It's weird.
It's weird. But do you have some thoughts about it? We both went to the University of Virginia.
Right.
Richard Spencer's alma mater. Steve Bannon went to Virginia Tech.
That's right.
And is from Richmond. So maybe we have a little intersection. I don't know. Did you ever meet a Steve Bannon type?
I didn't. I think I met a few people who were like proto Steve Bannons, right? Sort of like there's a type, because we're both UVA grads, I think you'll know the type, which is someone who is like too clever by half and too smart by half and like thinks that their ability to pull nonsense references from the books they read in college like constitutes an intellect.
Yeah.
Take that, Steve Bannon.
Right.
Yeah. He's really listening to us.
In trying to understand this guy, I mean, one serious possibility is that he's a bullshit artist, that he's the guy who has, he can reference Augustine or Thomas Aquinas because of a theology course he took in college, and that, in a White House where there's not a lot of competition for the title of top intellect, you sort of bamboozle each other.
Right,
you can bamboozle people that way.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think definitely there's some kind of incoherence there. I think this is a guy who's very impressed with his own perceived intellect. But I would say that he does seem to have like some defined ideas, and they're kind of all centered on or near this notion that the West is fighting this grand war against Islam, and that the only way to prevail is for basically to reconstitute a kind of Christendom, right? And so you have to get the white, and this is also Christendom defined racially as well. So you have to get the Russians on your side because they're fellow white Christians. You got to get your continental Europeans on your side because they're fellow white Christians. And you have to make the United States, of whom's identity is very fluid, a white Christian nation kind of in its bones, and unify against Islam. I think that's there, and it's coherent in the sense that like I could describe it to you in a couple sentences and it kind of made sense. It's not particularly coherent in its sort of correspondence to reality.
But does he worry about terrorism? I mean, the radical Islamic terrorism, that the name that is meant to condemn to hell every Muslim, they seem to be worried about terrorist activity. But Steve Bannon, not so much. I mean, he seems to want to affirmatively preserve some imagined civic society that codes as Judeo-Christian. I hate that way of doing it. I don't know why, but Judeo-Christian makes it seem inclusive or something. But
right.
Judeo-Christian set of values that are never quite named against the onslaught of some other ideology, but he doesn't seem like he's trying to save lives or particularly concerned about national security.
No, I think that's right. I think insofar that he has this worldview, it's very much this notion of both preserving this imagined Western past, exalting and kind of like white heteropatriarchal leadership.
Yeah.
And if scaring people about Muslims is what it's going to take to get people on your side, then Steve Bannon sees nothing wrong with scaring people about Muslims, although he does seem to have some kind of genuine hostility towards immigrants, right? Like it's not just pure fear mongering. He does really seem to think that American society is weakened, becomes less vigorous because we rely so much on immigrants.
So theory one, Steve Bannon believes in the clash of civilizations between the West and Muslims. And I will grant you that has considerable explanatory power. It's also grounded a little bit in this speech or this Skype thing he gave to the Vatican, which is kind of the place where he described his views. And among other things, that explains positive attitudes towards Russia, because Russian Orthodox Christians are part of this clash of civilization. They're on our side in that clash, in this worldview. And yes, Muslim ban. Muslims out. They're on the other side. Do you think that theory would appeal a lot to Donald Trump? I mean, I'm just thinking about it, and I think, yeah, I mean, look, that's been out there. The clash of civilization was an idea that was, of course, explicitly rejected by George W. Bush and his administration, and has been, you know, not a mainstream conservative or Republican theory until now. But I guess my skepticism about that is it doesn't quite explain enough. It doesn't explain how he got in there with Trump, what he sold Trump on. I don't think he's in there every day saying, you know, Mr. Trump, this is clash of civilizations going on and we're fighting back.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I feel like we got to establish that, like, who knows what Donald Trump cares about, right? Like, not a guy who's thought deeply about anything.
Well, the drapes in the White House.
White House drapes.
Wait, I mean, 15 like, swatches, did he look at?
As somebody who can appreciate interior decorating, I get it.
Well, what was the surprise there? He picked the gold. Yeah. I could have done that for him. Yeah.
So one thing it's worth saying is that Donald Trump has had a kind of defined worldview going back as early as the 80s, right? Like he's always been obsessed about foreigners beating America, about us making bad deals with foreigners. And if you go to his language about Japan in the 80s, you can just kind of switch out China or Mexico with Japan. And you have like a Donald Trump rant about this stuff from like 87. And I think it's noteworthy that Trump's thinking about this has always been kind of racialized. It's these brown foreigners of one way or another are a threat to our economic dominance. So I think first and foremost, Trump is a nativist. I think that's just kind of part of who he is. And he may have been attracted to Bannon on the basis of sort of Bannon and Breitbart in particular's kind of like explicitly xenophobic stance. But I wouldn't discount the degree to which Breitbart, the publication, spent so much time flattering Trump throughout the campaign right. from the beginning, and that Trump is someone who responds extremely well to flattery, and that this relationship they have may not necessarily be ideological. It may just be that Stephen Bannon knows how to talk to a man like Trump and make him think that he's valued, and Trump is, let's say he's not sophisticated enough to pick up on the con.
So here's yep. another theory, and then Virginia can tell me why I'm wrong. Republicans have been spending a lot of time for years talking about the Browning of America and the electoral implications of that. And generally, the thesis coming from people on the right has been, we can't continue to win presidential elections in particular, because a lot more people vote in presidential years than in midterm elections, without starting to attract Latinos, other non-white voters, because although they're not going to be the majority of the population until 2040, 2050, at some point, the percentage of the white vote that you need, on the assumption that you're not going to get much of the non-white vote, becomes overwhelming. I've always thought that was a pretty good thesis. The question is what year that becomes true. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have thought we were a little bit past the point where it was already true, and that's part of the surprise of Trump's election, is that he sort of overcame this demographic trend. Even though he didn't win the popular vote, he got elected. Seems to me, there's a Steve Bannon argument that we can stop this and maybe even reverse this trend. That it's not that we have to get a share of black votes and Latino votes. It's that we have to stop this Browning of America, because just in political terms, really, really bad news for the Republican Party. And we can stop it in a number of ways. We reduce African-American turnout by not enforcing the voting right, or preventing enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. We can slow down immigration, which will affect it in any number of ways. We can deport immigrants who might otherwise become citizens and vote. You do all these things, it makes long-term political sense. Do you think that might be what Steve Bannon has been telling Donald Trump?
This is the thousand-year Reich idea, that Bannon is trying to secure a place for centuries to come for Trump right. and his political descendants. You think so?
Yeah, I think that's definitely plausible. I think Bannon has caught on to something that maybe skeptics of the demographic transition argument always noted, which was that Republicans have demographic trouble winning the presidency as long as white voters as a mass continue to vote basically as they've been voting, like largely for Republicans, but not overwhelmingly for Republicans. And in that world, basically the country votes like, you know, Colorado or Virginia, right? Like some sizable minority of whites vote for the Democrats, and they win all the non-whites as well. But if all of a sudden America started voting like Mississippi or Alabama, where whites are voting sort of 70%, 80%, 90% for one party, then you can kind of win indefinitely as long as whites are the majority of the voting population. And I think Bannon has sort of figured out, right, that like if you basically try to radicalize America's white population, get them to start thinking of themselves as white people who are embattled, then you can kind of retard the growth of this democratic demographic majority. I don't know what Trump thinks about this. Like, again, so I really sincerely think that because Trump won, we've all begun to overestimate how competent and well thought out these people are, right? Yeah. Like, that
this is a well-known phenomenon in Washington.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, we were also stunned by Trump's win that we've forgotten the really important thing about Trump's win was that it was basically a fluke. Right, like it was. You run some number of simulations and you get some crazy result, and it just so happens we live in the dimension where that crazy. We live in the dimension where it's like the Berenstein Bears and Donald Trump won. Right, so like, so
that's Judeo-Christian values.
I mean, yeah. so. I think it's entirely plausible, right, that like Trump doesn't have. Bannon's flattering him. Bannon, you know, has some like crazy ideas about like, you know, the changing the course of global history, and he has this like malleable vessel in Trump, and Trump is just there, kind of happy to be there, hopes people will love him now, and they're kind of just stumbling through. And I think there's evidence to suggest that this is very much the case.
Does Bannon know that Trump thinks? I'm sorry. Does Trump know that Bannon thinks he's an idiot? That Bannon thinks he can put himself on the National Security Council and Trump will sign it without reading it.
You know, yeah. Bannon made a movie, a kind of very stirring documentary about Sarah Palin. And he has an interest in taking sort of what looks like stupidity and making it a noble American ideal. And I think he's so used to making that change in his mind that he probably doesn't tell himself even that he's doing that translation. I mean, you all know this. I think Stephen Bannon is a collapsitarian. I think he wants...
collapsitarian. Okay.
This is a Silicon Valley term. I think Peter Thiel probably conforms to it too. Universal joblessness, the destruction of, you know, all institutions from media to professional sports to manufacturing. And, you know, he's like a, I don't know, do people talk about Thanatos anymore, like the death drive?
Yeah.
They're just, you know, we talked, there was a lot of discussion of Eros and sexuality and gender during the campaigning. But if Freud is to be believed or pop psych is to be believed, the drive to destruction is just as powerful. And when you kept seeing articles of faith being inverted over and over during the campaign, and now, you know, to stomp in with an executive order, to talk about Frederick Douglass as though he was alive, and talk about his
own... He was really sorry he couldn't be with us. He's actually going to be on Rachel Maddow with Dahlia later tonight.
He's sitting shiva for the victims of the Bowling Green massacre, right? But, you know, to say the things, I don't know, to have Holocaust Remembrance Day and not mention Jews. I mean, these are like Nietzschean inversions. They're just like, what is, like, where we used to like life, now we like death. Where we used to like sanity, now we like florid psychosis.
Wait, you know? Does Steve Bannon want to kill himself or kill the rest of us?
Or
he doesn't want anyone to survive him, right? Like, he's so paralyzed by death that it's like, if I'm going to die, you must too. Right?
Well,
like,
I mean,
you guys have gotten very dark very quickly tonight.
but we've got
three whole segments.
I mean, I was like listening to The Cure before this. I'm like, my headspace is there.
But I think for some reason, the small detail on Bannon's resume that obsesses me is his foray into gaming when he had like a little World of Warcraft empire. Did anyone follow this? Where he committed pretty much the signature fraud of massively multiplayer online role-playing games is to pay people in China to mine gold for you so that like white people with Judeo-Christian values who play World of Warcraft can do better in the game. I mean, it's just like, it's as bad as it gets.
Wait, he cheated in this game he created?
Not only did he cheat, because some people, it's very... I mean, everyone knows this. With China. There's a tedious part of the game, which is mining gold. And so a lot of players want to advance in the game, but they don't want to do the tedious work of it. So they pay people a pittance abroad in order to do this for the game. But the point is, it's just like as bad as it gets. Like, there's nothing more just like despicable and tiny and gross. And it just suggests to me that Steve Bannon, who's also had done ideological 180s over and over again. His story, like Pence's, is that he was a Kennedy Democrat, union guy, and grew up that way. Then he was just a go-go 80s capitalist. Then he went in the Navy, and when he came home, he decided that things were just as bad under George W. Bush as they were under Carter. Then he hated hated all the parties and the whole establishment. Finally, he decided that he hated the rich because his father had been screwed over by the banks, but the banks had been the recipient of the socialist package that bailed them out. So I don't know where he stands vis-a-vis rich people who benefit from bailouts now that, you know, he's right. Trump's, now that he's ventriloquizing for Trump. But, you know, he's flipped so many times. I don't think that I believe that he is a... that he's just got his eye on the prize, that he's like a single theory philosopher who's just exercising, you know, his clear idea about the way the future should go. I think he, like a Lenin, like people have said he is. I don't think he's that at all. I think he's like a mischievous poltergeist figure.
Right.
You know? Not a devil, not like the Grim Reaper, but like a, he just makes chaos. You know?
I think there's a way to split the difference here. He's sort of like, you know, if history, you know, first is tragedy, second is farce, then he's sort of like like the farcical Carl Schmitt, right? Like kind of just this this guy who perceives himself to be the grand ideologue of Trumpism, but in fact is just sort of a miserable little imp who just happens to have the ear of the President of the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he made his money on Seinfeld. I mean, it's like he thinks he's Lenin, but he's really Kramer.
Right.
Yes, and we know where that ends.
He's Kramer under the spell of a death cult.
Exactly. In real life.
All right. We're moving on. We have a friend who's coming with us long distance to help us introduce our second topic tonight.
Hello, everybody. I'm so excited that Slate is having this program. And that you're looking at my fantastic foreign policy, specifically the tweets, tremendous tweets, amazing tweets. I am the best tweeter when it comes to foreign policy. So please learn from a master, and that master is me. Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind President Obama was to them, not me. Iran has been formally put on notice for firing a ballistic missile. Should have been thankful for the terrible deal the U.S. made with them. Do you believe it? The Obama administration agreed to take thousands of illegal immigrants from Australia. Why? I will study this dumb deal.
We're going to call this segment Foreign Policy in 140 Characters. I mean, you know, the horror that Trump was going to continue to tweet in office gave way to the greater horror that he was going to tweet at other countries.
Unbelievable.
You know, there are some special risks around foreign policy, just doing things impulsively and in real time. You know, it's been 2 weeks. He hasn't taken us to war on social media yet.
There was so many interesting consequences for the language in the election and during this administration. And one of the things I keep trying to imagine is when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad gets his briefing about the tweets to Iran, does someone walk him through how the Terminator became the governor of California and is an Austrian actor, bodybuilder turned actor, but now has The Apprentice and is getting not as good ratings as the President of the United States of America got when he originated the show. And that means he thinks that the deal with Iran, the nuclear deal with Iran that Obama did, is somehow too kind, and now we're going to be tough on him. I mean, what does that even translate into Farsi?
I mean, it's really interesting because I have a similar thought, just like, you know, so if Barack Obama had tweeted at China, like, you know, you guys are whack and we're going to go after you, right? Like, if that had happened, the Chinese would have taken it really seriously. They've been like, you know, Barack Obama's a serious man. He knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's doing. So if Barack Obama says this to us over Twitter, obviously the Holocaust, there's a nuclear Holocaust coming, right? Like, we're obviously all going to die.
We got to
have a first strike, right? Like, because this is a serious business. But Donald Trump is not a serious man, even though he's president of the United States. And does the Chinese leadership see his tweets and they say to themselves, we can't ignore this because this may have, you know, geopolitical implications, but also let's just like hold our horses. Let's not overreact. Let's like be calm about this because Americans elected a madman and we just have to like adjust accordingly.
Right. They're trying to figure out, I think like we all are, what model do we have of Trump that gives us enough predictive power to to decide on whether he's going to do something violent. That's the thing that I'm curious about, like whether he'll act on, you know, when we've talked about narcissism on the show, one thing that's interesting about malignant narcissists sort of going diagnosis of Trump is they're not actually violent. Like they make their families miserable, but they don't hit their wives and children. And I think it remains to be seen whether he's actually like an itchy. I don't think, you know, Saddam Hussein had actually murdered people.
Right.
By the time he was in office. And Putin is a quite violent guy. I don't know. I see him being defensive and liking walls and bans and being safe in his house, but I just don't see him throwing a punch. And so I think that trying to read his tweets, like, is he really going to like press the button?
Yeah,
right. But I mean, it's funny. You know, you talk about China, and there was that episode right at the beginning where he took the call from Taiwan, and that would have been, as you say, if Barack Obama had done it, that would have been a vast provocation, calling into question all of our policy with China. And China's reaction to that was like, eh, you know, he got duped. Basically, Taiwan's lobbyists got him to make the call, which seems like maybe partly true, partly not. But it gives, you know, in China it's the opposite extreme, because if Donald Trump has the attention span of a minute, they're thinking hundreds of years.
Right.
And it definitely gives a huge advantage to the long-term thinkers. And one of the ways it gives them the advantage is they can choose to interpret his actions any way they want.
Mm. Right.
The risk comes if there is someone equally impulsive or impulsive in a different way, kind of on the other end of the line. Because otherwise, and you know, you saw this with Australia too, right? I mean, he had this, you know, he had this snit fit,
yeah,
you know, totally pointless against, you know, one of America's longest and strongest allies. And the Australian Prime Minister didn't take the bait. Right.
Then
the line is, well, you know, it was a useful exchange in views.
But your point is for an equally hot-headed world leader, it could be a pretext for...
Well, we do have a few of those.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Iran, you know, we heard the Iran tweets is, you know, not a hotbed of mental health.
And
like the United States.
Iran looks, you know, a perfectly rational actor when you think about Kim Jong-un. And I think,
yes,
you know, part of what President Obama was trying to impress on Trump that was actually a big deal about being president is there's a big crisis brewing with North Korea that he's going to have to handle. And that's the one that worries me being handled on Twitter.
So that train of thought has me thinking just about, again, how other countries relate to us now that Trump is president. And part of me wonders if it won't be kind of a soft situation like with North Korea. So, like, the thing about North Korea is that everyone recognizes that this is an awful regime, that the leadership is unstable and dangerous, but no one really wants to do anything about it. Everyone, China, South Korea, the U.S., Japan, everyone's content kind of just to, like, to let the provocations pass, to kind of just, like, keep the temperature down as much as it can.
Lack of really good options.
Right. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, if North Korea collapses, we have a massive refugee crisis that could create like an armed conflict on the Korean Peninsula again. We don't want to, you know, we don't really want to have to be responsible, frankly, with the humanitarian catastrophe that would come with the collapse of that regime.
Well, thousands of conventional missiles pointed at Seoul. I mean, the amount of damage that they can do to South Korea is unfathomable.
So,
but I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, so
we're that now.
Yeah, we're that now, right? Yeah. The United States is indispensable to the global order as it currently exists. And the rival challengers here, right, are China and Russia. And a lot of other, you know, liberal democracies not so liberal, liberal states not as democratic as they could be, kind of like want the status quo to stay where it is. And so do they basically say, listen, okay, America gets having some problems right now.
Yeah.
We get
we're just going to wait this one out.
We're just going to hope that the opposition party gets its stuff together in 4 years and we'll be back to something that's normal. And in the meantime, when your president does something bananas, we'll just pretend like it didn't happen.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I think, I mean, Kim Jong-un is a useful comparison in the, I mean, I don't know why. I don't, all right.
Yeah.
As they, okay.
Oh, God.
Because in trying to find still a typology of character for Donald Trump, I keep coming back to, all right, on Project Runway, one of the most damning things they used to say about a designer was, I have questions about the taste level. And I mean, the first thing that comes up, we're supposed to now not talk about his hair and skin anymore because we're supposed to be beyond that. But it is outrageously interesting to me how tonally wrong both Trump and Kim Jong-un are, and how that, when you know, in this discussion of like, if Obama had said, China's whack and we're going to kill you, that would have meant another thing. But with Trump, who lets Melania stand behind him and walks up the stairs in advance of her and wears his tie too long and says the opposite of what he should at every given time, he's just, the taste level is so wrong. He's so discourteous in such a profound way that he can only be read as noise, you know? And I do think that there's something in the, like, whatever could make you wake up and style yourself like Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump speaks to how you exist vis-a-vis other people, you know? And so, I think you're right that there's something, people are just too squeamish around North Korea and maybe now around the United States. Like, we're the ones that are like, let him serve out his shift and, you know, we'll get through this.
Right. So say you are one of the countries in the world that faces very serious issues in which the United States is crucial. Say, for example, you're a leader of Ukraine, like Mr. Poroshenko, who I think Trump talked to maybe over the weekend. What's the advice
for
that?
Did he really? He had a prepare for war conversation with him.
Don't count on us. Yeah. No, the cavalry's not coming. Should they basically be sitting it out and hoping Trump isn't president even for 4 years, or at the worst case scenario, going in 4 years? Or do they have to, at some level, accept this as American policy? Now, it's a really interesting point you make. Basically, should the rest of the world assume this is a bad dream for which we're going to wake up pretty soon?
I mean, I think this is really interesting because between what the two of you have said, is I'm getting the sense that that is pretty much the policy of all of us. It's just like, this is a nightmare. Let's try to get through this. And the danger is, one, that we might mirror his psychosis or the psychosis of this administration and start doing crazy things. Or two, that other bad actors, will use it as a pretext.
Right.
Not that they're actually provoked, but that they already had intentions of undermining liberal democracy elsewhere, and they'll use Trump's election to wreak more havoc.
You mentioned earlier that Trump is comfortable within walls and sequestered away from other people. That's perfect for an expansionist power, right? Who now knows that the United States is not going to say much of anything or do much of anything substantive.
That's right.
If you decide to take another little chunk of Ukraine, if you decide to send some aircraft carriers, near Taiwan.
Yeah, America first might mean we'll leave you alone.
Right.
You guys take care of your thing.
Jamel, how do you feel about opponents of Donald Trump calling themselves the resistance?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I feel like when George W. Bush was president, if Democrats had said whether the resistance, would have been offensive.
Right, yeah. Right, and then it was just sort of like, yeah, Bush sucks, we'll beat him.
Right,
and
but this term's catching on. Like, at rallies, people think of themselves as the resistance.
So I'm okay with it for two reasons. The first is that I do think Trump represents a unique threat to American pluralism and democracy. I'm not going to go as far as say that Trump is sort of like, you know, un-American, because Trump very much comes out of a very well-defined and easily identifiable American tradition of illiberalism and nativism and xenophobia. But a kind of America that millions of people really love and cherish, the pluralistic, uppercase L liberal place where we honor Martin Luther King Jr. And that America, I think, gets under threat from Trump. So given the stakes in this case, given that, like, we're kind of facing kind of the, you know, the shambling body of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
then the resistance is fine. The second reason is So if you spend too much time on Twitter like I do, you notice that people like to analogize politics as things that are close in their lives. And on Twitter, for a lot of people, that's Harry Potter. A lot of millennials, near millennials, read a lot of Harry Potter. And that's sort of like their pop cultural schema for understanding conflicts like this. And some people find that very annoying and very juvenile and very childish. I think it's okay, right? Like, I think it's okay that if people's pop cultural touchstones are like bands of people against authoritarian states, whether it's Star Wars or Harry Potter or whatever, or the Hunger Games, then like, if that's what they understand these things, hey, I'm not gonna yell at you for doing that. You understand this as you need to understand it. And I think the resistance as a name for this does tap into those touchstones for people. For people who, you know, again, the Hunger Games, Harry Potter, Star Wars, any number of other properties, I think it does capture something that has captivated people, and specifically captivated people who were very much against Trump, and who find themselves a bit adrift. It gives them a way of orienting themselves in the world.
All right. I like it too. I kind of like it.
Okay,
good. All right, let's go for it.
That's it for that topic. But, you know, I think when my grandchildren ask me what I did in the resistance, I'm going to say I read Dahlia Lithwick every day.
That's right.
And she told me what to do. And now I'd like to welcome her onto the stage, Slate's jurisprudence columnist and the host of the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, are you back there? Come join us. Welcome, Dahlia.
Hey.
We wanted to have you because we love you, and also because we have had on our minds the topic of constitutional crisis. What a constitutional crisis is. Are we having one now? How will we know when we're having one? What do we do about it when we are having one?
What are the symptoms?
What are the symptoms?
Side effects?
9 out of 10 dentists agree.
Help us out here. Now, I know you've been backstage checking the updates from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California. So whether it's a crisis or not, what's going on right now?
What's going on is they're going to hear oral argument tomorrow. Just on this question of the stay. In other words, they're not going to talk about the merits, but the Ninth Circuit, 3-judge panel. Adorably, they're doing this telephonically, like it's still 1977. and so they're going to have an hour argument tomorrow night just to determine whether to extend the stay or whether to terminate the stay. And last I checked, there are a very funny series of amicus briefs coming in, one from John Kerry and other sort of national security people saying, like, oh, my God, leave the stay in place. One from a whole bunch of other states who have now piled on and said, we want in on this action, too. So it's fun times at the Ninth Circuit.
And are they citing in those briefs, are they using law, like case law or precedent?
No.
Oh, they're just saying.
Unicorns, ponies. Yeah. No, they are citing law. I mean, there's, you know, a very, very clear legal standard of when you grant a stay. And, you know, there are tests that you go through. And the questions are, you know, there's sort of 4 stages of questions. But one is, you know, likelihood of succeeding on the merits down the line. Mm-hmm. And one is, you know, irreparable harm to the parties if you don't grant the stay. So they're sort of working through those things. And one of the questions that's emerging that's kind of funny is that the Justice Department is claiming there's going to be irreparable harm to the Justice Department if this stay stays in effect. And you want to tell them, no, you are so much better today than you were a week ago. Just put your heads down and say thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's an interesting question, though. I mean, you know, he hasn't even confirmed his attorney general yet. I mean, these people in the Justice Department, a lot of them are not political appointees, but there's no reason to think they sympathize or agree with Donald Trump. I mean, where does he find lawyers in the Justice Department who are on his side to argue his case in the Ninth Circuit, or doesn't that matter?
Well, it's been fun to watch. I shouldn't say fun. It's fun if you're me to watch some of the lawyers who are trying to argue on behalf of the Justice Department, and they're sort of doing their best effort to be like, we need this stay. It's an emergency. And you can sort of see the thought bubble over their head is like, sweet God, how did I get myself into this gig?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, even, I mean, they're doing, I think, the best that they can do, but, you know, watching.
But they're phoning it in.
Watching, yeah. Watching in the Washington State case, you know, this poor woman who's just like, oh, kill me now, kill me now.
What do they say? I mean, what is the best that can be said in lawyer language?
There's a very, very good argument that says that the president has broad plenary discretionary power over immigration. And by the way, these were the same arguments that were made about DACA, right? I mean, these are not trivial arguments that the president has huge discretion, and statutory and otherwise, to do what he or she, let's say, needs to do to protect our borders. And so these are good arguments. And I think if you get to the merits of this case, it's not an easy case. I mean, there are really good arguments, all the ones we heard last year at DACA, arguments at the court about why the president gets to do things like this. But, you know, I think the real problem is that we haven't seen a ban that is a religious ban. And Trump did himself no favors when he said, oh, no, this is just about country of origin. Yeah. And, you know, once he did that and said, this is a Muslim ban, I'm just not calling it a Muslim ban, he did not help himself or his lawyers at all.
The every once in a while, someone gets a phrase across that just nails it. But I thought Ben Wittes, a legal writer in Lawfare, when he first described this executive order, he said malevolence mitigated by incompetence, you know, which just seemed to nail it. But the incompetence was partly because they rushed this thing. They did it so fast. I mean, all right, presumably they've learned their lesson a little bit. Why not right now redo it, do over on the executive order, a more legally sound one that can pass constitutional muster, take out some countries, put in some countries, do whatever they have to do. But, I mean, everyone sort of agrees as a version of this, they could get past. They were just so half-assed about how they did it that they blew their opportunity.
Jacob, zip it. you're giving too many good ideas.
Yeah. Don't tell the president.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry. Trump listens to nothing. He only watches CNN. So you're safe here. You say here, it's a safe space.
You know, what? One of the interesting Jacob and I were joking in the green room about what does it matter that John Kerry and Madeleine Albright are, you know, putting out a national security argument about this. One of the interesting paragraphs in their brief is, had there been genuine interagency coordination, if we believed at any level that national security people had been looped into this decision-making process, we would really have more confidence in giving the president unfettered authority to do things. But this seems to have been cooked up in an underground lab, you know, with like two interns and a pony. And I think that there's a feeling that, you know, when you say you're going to give the president certain discretion and certain authority, it assumes that agencies are being consulted. And I don't think that's a totally trivial argument. In other words, I think once you're staffed up, and you have people saying, you know, this actually really does make our allies extremely angry and embolden ISIS, I think that it may be harder to do this regardless. So part of what's weird about this is, yes, it was sloppy, but also I don't think that everybody that needed to weigh in, even to make it a constitutionally plausible order, has weighed in yet.
Yeah.
I mean, this gets to my kind of, and I'd like to be curious to know what you think about this, Delia, my general sense that, like, we're generally overstating the level of, like, diabolicalness in this administration and understating the level of just, like, extreme incompetence. And, yeah, what do you think? I mean, do you think that what we're witnessing, what this is an example of, is not some plan, but basically you have a bunch of people who have never worked in government before who also think that, like, they are the greatest minds who ever existed?
I it's funny because we were having this argument this morning. Jack Goldsmith, who worked in the Bush administration, headed the Office of Legal Counsel, had a really kind of terrifying post today that said, look, the reason Trump was going after judges, you know, by name and actually trying to incite anger towards a specific judge isn't just incompetence. He's trying to sort of destabilize things.
The whole judiciary, right?
And it's always, you know, my response when you get into these arguments is yes and. Yeah. Yes, it's incompetent. And yes, it's also, if you want to impute three-dimensional chess, you know, moves, moves, it's also that. In other words, I don't know. I'm just not savvy enough to know whether these things are just, you know, blindly mishandled or there's some incredible long game that I'm not getting. But I'm willing to concede that both could be true, or at the very least that you can turn something that was a huge, bumbled, ill-thought-out maneuver into something that can destabilize the entire judicial branch. I think that
has it interested you to see that in the resistance that lawyers have become heroes, that this and all these judges, many of them women, who weighed in so quickly on the ban and were really, really willing to call it what it is from the beginning. And this, you've probably seen the hashtag, like, lawyers are the first responders, lawyers are the new first responders. And it's very powerful, you know, that sort of, if we can't rally behind the executive branch of the legislature, like, what's left? And then the rumors that Steve Bannon had even deleted the judiciary from the WhiteHouse.gov website. I mean, that's, I don't know.
Your question to Dahlia is she happy that lawyers are now heroes?
That lawyers and judges are the resistance heroes. Yes, and gods.
First of all, speaking on behalf of the lawyers, we always knew we were the heroes. We just didn't show it right off. I mean, I think there was something, you know, I remember when the sort of airport revolution happened, you know, last Saturday night, and you saw all these guys with like triple thick glasses, many of them women, by the way, hunched over their laptops, you know, at the airports. And I just remember being like, well, there we are. Look
that
at
was
us.
Inspiring.
You know?
That was inspiring.
I just kept thinking the framers were like, yes, you know, this is what makes this country different, is that there is. And I think, you know, it's such a double-edged sword, because I think, you know, on the one hand, we really revere the rule of law. We revere the Constitution. I always sort of say, for a secular country, we sure built a big old temple, you know, at One First Street. And that reverence is really powerful. It's also incredibly fragile. Mm-hmm. And we forget that the judicial branch, the rule of law, the Constitution are not self-executing. They're not self-protecting. And so I think that there's a way in which the sort of natural tentativeness of lawyers initially to just race in and just do stuff, you know, and like, let's just do stuff. We're lawyers and there's law.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that didn't happen. But the minute there was something to do and a really, I think, clear and cognizable threat.
Yeah.
Boy, we were there like that. And I think it's not an accident that, you know, the first, I don't want to essentialize this, but I think the first 4 or 5 rulings that came down in the first 24 hours were women judges. I think women probably are, you know, acting up the best of their ability in this profession. And I think it's really interesting.
Do you have any sense of why that might be? I mean, just Hillary obviously was a lawyer and identified as a lawyer and presented herself like a lawyer. So maybe I don't know. What do you think? Why? Ann Donnelly and Sally Yates and, I mean, they aren't the judge specifically, although Ann Donnelly is one of the judges you're talking about.
And Leonie Brinkema, I mean, it was amazing. You know, 2 judges in Boston, both women. And it's, again, I don't think it's because they were women, but I think women were awful quick to say, all right, I'll say it.
Yeah.
This sucks.
Yeah. I think the march helped that. I really do. I think the march had this backdrop of consensus that made you, I don't know, more able on day 2 to kind of call bullshit.
I think that, and I think, you know, that rollout of Neil Gorsuch in this sort of, you know, White House ceremony that was like, white guy, white guy, white guy, white guy. Mrs. Scalia, white guy, white guy, white guy. You know, I think that was really, like, I just felt like, is it really 1920? Like, this is so weird. And it was just visually quite
It's weird they don't bother with tokenism.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was Mrs. Scalia. But, I mean, I think it's, you know, I do think there's a weird way in which, if you are used to the Obama White House and what any rollout looked like, much less a Sotomayor or a Kagan, to just see this wall of guys who look like my uncle, all of them, it is kind of motivating.
Yeah.
So Virginia was talking earlier about how Trump reacts when he is thwarted and cornered. And this is getting back to the constitutional crisis question. Over the weekend, his tweet about the so-called judge. People say, you know, you're calling the judiciary into question. You know, constitutional crisis. What would it look like if it happened? And could it happen in reaction to this ruling? Say the Court of Appeals stays the stay or doesn't unstay the stay or whatever the language is. He's defeated. He's dealt this humiliation, and these judges have stopped him. Is there any world in which he tries to go around that in an extra constitutional way, that is, issues an order to Homeland Security, immigration, customs agents, enforce my ban, that I don't recognize the ruling?
I think we were closer to it last week. I think when Leon and Mark Stern and I wrote that piece about, holy cow, is this a constitutional crisis? Like, it was interesting because, we went through our Rolodex calling con law professors and we were like, holy cow, is this a constitutional crisis? And they were all like, I don't know. I don't know what it would look like. This isn't Little Rock. This is something else. Huh. And what was interesting was, to the extent that some of them really felt it was going to manifest quickly, they said it is. It's going to be CBP officials and federal marshals, at the arrivals terminal at Dulles, with weapons. Now, I think that has gone away because I think the compliance with the order has been so complete since Friday. So it's not going to be that. But it's interesting because when you sort of try to imagine what the next iteration of that might look like, it's hard to say. It's just, I think, some version of, this is the first president, at least in, our history, including Nixon, who just thinks the courts are silly. And that's, it's in a deep, deep way, I feel like he comes at it the way any business person comes at it, not a constitutional thinker, which is like, well, but when they're wrong, I just need to pay a guy or beat someone up and then I get the right decision. It's not this notion that there's this overarching rule of law or this system or checks. There's just bad judges and good judges. And if you, deride a bad one long enough, you'll get your outcome you want.
We're going to take some questions, but while people get set up, we can ask you a little more. But we're going to have microphones up here and here. And if you want to ask a question, come towards the front. But in the meantime, I didn't mean to cut you off, Jamel, but I wanted to know about Gorsuch, what you think. I mean, and how do we deal with Gorsuch in the context of what happened to Merrick Garland? I mean, I think I've been reading all the coverage, and I guess my feeling is that Gorsuch is someone it's probably about the least terrible thing Trump's done. I mean, he's qualified, he's intelligent, he's someone who would, in ordinary circumstances, get confirmed. But he follows on this kind of mini coup where we haven't had a Supreme Court justice for over a year because the Republicans decided to create a new precedent that we've never had before, that the Democrats don't get to confirm a justice if you are in some undefined range of a future election. Of course, you're always in range of a future election. So what should we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question that Senate Democrats are, drinking themselves to death over right now. Mm. I think they're trying to figure out, is this the hill we die on? We've clearly been completely, slurred and maligned, that we have no sort of ability to stop this other than with a filibuster. Is this worth killing the filibuster over? And I think, some of what we're hearing is, well, since it's Scalia's seat anyway, or, we're not changing the aggregate, composition of the court, maybe this isn't the one we fight about. But the notion that the next one is going to be the one we fight about strikes me as a little bit silly. And the only other thing I would say about Gorsuch, Jacob, and I think this is so important, is that he is now getting tethered to this rule of law conversation and executive power conversation, that he does not want his confirmation hearings to be a referendum on, are you going to be, a rubber stamp for this president? Are you a total wuss? How do we know you're not a wuss? Those are not, I mean, he has not written extensively on this. Why would he? He's not, it's not come across his desk. But the idea now that his entire confirmation conversation is going to be tagged to the president who hates judges is really fraught for him.
He just wants to talk about his Hobby Lobby victory.
Well, and that and skiing.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I don't see anybody standing up to ask questions. Is that because you all work for the federal government and you don't want to be? You don't have to identify yourself, but you do have to just one instruction. Please ask a pointed, short question. Don't do what I do and give a little speech in the guise of asking a question. Actually, ask a question.
Hi there. Thanks for being here. So what's the game plan for Republican politicians? what do they do from here? If this administration really tanks, they're in trouble. Is part of what they're doing now to consolidate the white vote and to try to strengthen that and motivate that? Just want your thoughts. Thank you.
I'm going to point that one at Jamel.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I think if this administration really tanks, which, I mean, we have to, like, have a new definition of what really tanks means. Because if it's, we're barely two weeks and a couple days past inauguration, and we're already discussing constitutional crises.
Yeah.
When that's where you are, and I think last I checked, his Gallup approval was like 40%, and it's bad for him. Arguably, he's like in the process of tanking. I think there's a real possibility, right, that like come next November, it won't really matter what Republicans are trying to do because they'll have lost their seats. That like. I do firmly believe that like nothing in politics is static, and it is entirely possible, just within the realm of possibility, that this creates a kind of sustained wave that kind of just wipes out a majority, no problem, no question. Assuming that doesn't happen, assuming something less than that happens, I do think that Republicans, recognizing the kind of tenuous position they may be in, will really start to move rapidly on doing what they can to consolidate whatever electoral advantage they have. And so, you know, this proposed voter fraud commission from the White House, I think it's just a stalking horse for whenever Attorney General or whenever Jeff Sessions is confirmed, and they can use the Department of Justice to begin purging voter rolls in the guise of kind of cleaning up voter rolls. And they can begin sort of both scrutinizing efforts like those in Oregon or in Colorado to expand voting, and then removing scrutiny from efforts to restrict voting, kind of tilt the playing field in that direction as much as possible. You know, in Virginia, the House of Delegates in committee is a bill that would allocate electoral college votes by congressional district rather than winner take all, which, you know, on its face, sounds like, yeah, this is kind of fair. But in practice, what that means is that you're gerrymandering the Electoral College, taking advantage of existing gerrymandered maps to make it easier for a Republican candidate to win electoral votes. And so I would not be surprised. Hate to sound really depressing right now, but I would not be surprised if in the states with more radical Republican legislatures, you're going to start seeing a move towards that kind of thing, to institutionalize advantages that the Republican Party, that are currently kind of contingent right now, but to make them solid. The one reason to think that won't happen is that if that were to happen, I do think that would just completely throw the legitimacy of our political system into question, right? That like at a certain point, people would just say, hey, why are we even doing this? Because it's not fair. Like this is why I think Republicans should hope that if Trump happens to win re-election in 2020, that he does so with a popular vote majority. Because it's one thing, we already had two of these, right? Like a third one, you get to the point where people are like, "Fuck this system," right? Like if more people can't win, then what's the point? And so that's the moderating force there, that like counter-majoritarianism can only go so far before you do see a backlash.
I mean, we tend to look at them and say, you know, how can they be so stupid? But members of Congress are calculating machines. They are supercomputers when it comes to re-election, right? And, you know, whether they're 51 votes against Betsy DeVos in the Senate is going to depend on, you know, a confluence of factors, including Trump's approval rating. And so, but ultimately, it is going to depend on one more senator making the calculation, I'm more likely to get reelected if I vote against her than if I vote for her.
There's a line from Batman number one, Action Comics number one, where Bruce Wayne describes criminals as a cowardly and frightful lot. And that basically applies to politicians across the board. And so if they feel that they're in danger from Trump, they'll act accordingly.
Yeah. Next question.
Hi. Thank you all so much for coming out. My question has to do with this idea of rebellion, of the resistance, because over the weekend we saw quite a few Democratic elected officials come out to airports and speak in favor of these immigrants, these travelers who are banned from the U.S. So my question is, what do Democratic individual politicians have to gain from Trump's presidency? What is, or is there political capital on the table for them to take advantage of?
question. Dahlia, you want to take a crack at that? I saw you nodding.
Well, I'm only nodding because I think that, you know, I've been sort of chuckling that, you know, all the states that Washington State approached initially to join this lawsuit, and, you know, Minnesota was in it, but it took a couple days, I think, for other states to join in. And to me, that sort of signals that it's public, huge public outcry and resistance that is motivating, you know, Democrats who are holding elected office. And I think, you know, one of the things that's been very weird and destabilizing is you keep looking around and being like, where are the grown-ups? You know, where are our grown-ups in this? And I think, you know, the Women's March was a really good example of we are going to have to be our own grown-ups, and I think we're going to have to drag our elected officials kicking and screaming, you know, to do. So I do think that Democrats are incredibly responsive, but only once they figure out that we are going to be in their grill, as the as we now say. But I do think that it's really, really they need the signaling to come, I think, from the resistors and not vice versa.
I mean, we were Virginia. We were, you know, Democrats were tisking the Tea Party in, you know, 2009. How, you know, what bad manners? How unfair? How terrible? And now they're starting to pick up the Tea Party playbook, and they're kind of enjoying it.
Definitely, kind of enjoying it. Yeah, there have been suggestions about overwhelming town hall kind of meetings, the way the Tea Partiers used to, peppering questions at the local level, and then also blocking Gorsuch. You know, would just be clear, when they go low, we go low. Like, it's just, that's just, you know, they did it to us, so now it's your turn. We can't blame people, even Democrats, for dragging their feet. I mean, everyone is. What was the Carter administration, like, overcome by events, OBE? Like, that has never been more applicable than now. I mean, everyone has had to do these personal reckonings with, what are they in this for? Who are they serving? What do they even want to accomplish? I mean, you know, this thing of Paul Ryan only wants his tax break. Just give him his tax break and so we can start impeachment. You know, you just...
We dig that deal. Yeah, we'll take exactly. that deal. What is, Dahlia, what are the odds that Gorsuch ends up being confirmed in time to vote on the appeal of the stay?
I don't think good, and I think that it reinforces itself, because I think the Supreme Court, there's no way the Supreme Court is going to wade into this while they're 4-4. And so I think, in a weird way, if any, you know, thing comes to the court initially, the court's going to kick it away and say, you know, we're going to pile this up with the other cases we're not going to hear until we have 9. So I think the court, you know, has no interest in taking this until Gorsuch is on. And at the same time, that really amps up the pressure on, what are you going to do about this? You know, what are you going to do about this? So I think it's not to anyone's benefit in some way. But I do think that the court is going to have to wait at some level until at least there's a circuit split or some, you know, principled reason that they can hear it. Because I don't think they want to wade into this right now, particularly, you know, as a sort of counter-majoritarian check that doesn't even have a majority. It, like, would make your head explode. So,
but it's a prisoner's dilemma, because the court doesn't want to rule without 9 justices. And the Democrats don't want to confirm the 9th justice because he could be a vote on the decision.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like a filibuster to me.
It's not fun for anyone. And I think that if I'm right, that Democrats are going to fight Gorsuch now, not just on the principled Merrick Garland argument, but also on the, you know, if you're the guy who's the rubber stamp, we're going to have a problem with that, then they really do have, I mean, I do think he'll ultimately get confirmed, but I think that they have a real interest in having this conversation during his hearings, and that's going to be quite, quite, quite different from if this weren't going on.
I think we take 2 more quick questions. Was there one here? Went away. Are you a question? So I'm sorry we're not going to get any more, but we'll do one here and one here at least, and then see how we're doing.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. So earlier you mentioned impeachment. So what cover does Ryan and McConnell need to start impeachment? I mean, obviously Trump's done some things that would trigger impeachment in other eras, but now it seems like the standards are different. When do they start impeachment?
Well, you're looking at me.
Can we get the show on the road?
I mean, I think there might be a certain amount of projection in thinking that they want impeachment and are, like, waiting for the right time. I don't see any sign that they have the slightest interest in having this guy out of office. In fact, I think they see it as Dahlia was getting, as you were getting at, as a, you know, opportunity to get their agenda through. But I can't imagine a war. I mean, first of all, impeachment's still a big deal. Mm-hmm. You need a base for impeachment. I don't think we have one yet. I think there's a pretty good chance we'll get one. But I do not see a world in which a Republican Congress impeaches Trump. I mean, he would, the level of proven criminality would have to be well beyond what is almost imaginable. I think the odds of impeachment revolve around Democrat recapture of Congress, which is a long shot, particularly in Senate. But
I sort of have two thoughts. The first, I think you're right. I'm not sure either Ryan or McConnell are particularly interested in impeachment, or won't be until, like, you know, if Trump is, you know, hitting 60-65% disapproval, which I don't think is out of the range of possibility, given that on election day last year his favorability was like at 37%. So in my head, 37% is like a possible floor for Donald Trump, maybe even a little lower. At that level, when you're looking at your whole project being not just like your project being dragged down to the drain, but potentially sort of you forever being tarred as the people who enabled this, then I think impeachment might become a thing they start thinking about or envisioning. And if that happens, right, like I tend to think that anything can be, I mean, not literally anything, but like many things can be impeachable offenses. I don't actually agree that like there needs to be some sort of hard, clear thing. You know, what was Bill Clinton impeached for? Lying under oath. What was Andrew Johnson impeached for? Andrew Johnson was impeached basically because he pissed off the Republican Congress. Like, that's it. Like, they found some bullshit reason to say, hey, we got to impeach Andrew Johnson. That was it. And I think if Ryan and McConnell get to the point where they want to impeach Donald Trump, they will find some bullshit reason to say, we got to impeach Donald Trump. Now, whether or not that will help them rehabilitate their historical reputations is an entirely different question. And if they don't think it will, then I think, you know, impeachment's like not ever going to be on the table.
And there's never been an impeachment with a same party Congress.
No.
Right.
No.
And can I just put in a play, just one pitch for my Ben and Jerry's flavor of the month, which is emolument, because I really do think...
Oh, that's where they get it.
I do think that insofar as it's the boringest grounds, I also think the sort of self-dealing corruption, you know, today was the day we were supposed to get an answer from the GSA. I just think there's this rolling furball of corruption and self-dealing that at some point, if you're looking for a reason, it could be that.
In Johnson's case, it was like he dismissed Edward Stanton as Secretary of War when he really shouldn't have done so without proper consultation. And so it was like, you know, it was illegal, I guess.
It was politics.
Right? Yeah, and then they decided to impeach him.
White shirt, please.
Okay. Yes. Hi. I have a question about your guys' thoughts on Ivanka and Jared and kind of how they reconcile their role in this administration, which seems so at odds with the carefully crafted, cultivated image of themselves that they've put out there, particularly Jared with the anti-Semitism that's so rampant in this administration and the refugee ban when his grandparents were refugees.
Well, I'll give you my take on it. You know, when the Chicago 7 conspiracy, Chicago 10 conspiracy trial in Chicago was tried by a famous Jewish judge called Judge Hoffman. And Abby Hoffman, who was one of the defendants, famously described him. He said, "Ashanda for the Goyim," translated from Yiddish, means it's an embarrassment for the Jews in front of the Gentiles. And I would say of Jared Kushner, "Ashanda for the Goyim." But
Ashanda, actually, outside his synagogue on Fifth Avenue, there's a there's someone constantly walking around with a sign that says "Shanda Shame." I don't know what to make of them. I don't know what to make of them.
All right, that's a pass.
Jim
Allen, grab your wallet and the Nordstrom decision is to like not carry her brand. Some of this boycotting action has been surprisingly effective. So who knows? But the just like we now hate all the Trumps and everything they do is just kind of culturally funny. You know, that just like her accessories line, there's something fascist about it.
Actually, I think there's something to that. But.
We'll have to save that for another show.
Maybe. So there's this really interesting book that came out last year called The Case for Uncle Tom. And it's a really good book, and it doesn't sound like what you might think it is. What it is, it's an argument in favor of intergroup policing, right? That, like, groups have a right to say who belongs and who does not. And in this case, in the case of the book, the argument is that, like, this is why the term Uncle Tom has a really, and this is written by an African-American scholar, has a really important function in the Black community, because it is our way of policing who belongs and who does not. As far as I'm concerned, if Jewish Americans want to say that Jared Kushner isn't one of us, you can do it.
Thank you, Jamel.
The facts are on your side as far as I see them. It's kind of how I feel about Ben Carson these days. But real quick on Ivanka. I tend to think that Ivanka is very much a part of the Trump family and is very much aware of everything that's wrong with her father. I also think that she is playing a very particular role, which is sort of like which is that she is supposed to, like, embody this kind of idealized, like, capitalist white womanhood, and that's her whole brand, and that fits very well with the Trump thing of, you know, home, family, tradition. And I think she's very much a conscious part of this in ways that aren't immediately obvious, but are totally there.
Though you're wearing full Ivanka tonight, aren't you? So
I would just say, you know, that column about, was it Frank Bruni, about how pale and small and thin Jared Kushner was becoming. It was such a strange piece of, it was like, he's really skinny. He looks so sad. And it was such a, I felt like I could never get to the point where I felt bad for him. And after I read that column, and he's this sort of wraith-like figure just haunting the White House, so hoping someone will pay attention to him, I have to say my heart went out to him a little bit.
I mean, we keep talking about him as though what he embodies most is New York Jewishness. But he is, I mean, I don't know how well it's understood down here, but from a very particular sort of gangsterish crowd of Northern New Jersey Jewish families. What's the name for that?
Parole is what his dad is on after spending time in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So these aren't, right, these aren't like the Hoffman lawyer. They're a different crowd.
Could you imagine if Barack Obama had a close advisor from Chicago whose dad had served time in prison?
Yeah.
Could you imagine what the reaction would be?
His son-in-law.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I had to take off the glasses for dramatic effect.
That was nice. Go.
That was good.
It is amazing.
I think that's it for our live show. Go.
Well done.
Thank you, Virginia. Thank you, Jamel. Thank you, Dahlia, for joining us. Thank you, audience. You have been fantastic.
Yes.
We will definitely do this again. It was great. I want to thank the good folks at the Hamilton Theater here. This is a great place. This is really nice. The food was good, too, right? Yeah. Tip your waiters. Just a few more credits. Jason DeLeon produces TrumpCast. Faith Smith and Kirsten Holtz from Slate produced tonight's live show. Thank you, Faith and Kirsten. I want to thank our sound engineer, Jason Gambrell. He's back there. You can't see him. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. John DiDomenico is our voice of Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thank you for joining us tonight in Washington.